And welcome to this Innovation Forum Ethical Trade and Human Rights webinar series. I'm Ian Welsh, and I'll be your co-host for the next 45 minutes or so, and along with my colleague Toby Webb, your co-host over the 7 sessions we have lined up for you over the next 2 days. Our thanks to you all for your understanding that we couldn't hold the event in London this week. We're working with our hosts to find revised dates. As I'm sure you can understand, the situation is fast moving, but we will, of course, be in touch when we have some firm news on dates later in the year. When we realised that we weren't going to be able to meet today in person, we were determined that at least some of the important conversations should at least be started via these webinars and then continued when we meet later in the year. So, to start our series off, for the next 45 minutes or so, we are going to be talking about evolving legislation and worldwide compliance and how to keep ahead of the regulatory curve. To frame our discussion, I'm joined by 4 business experts. We have John Morrison, Chief Executive of the Institute for Human Rights and Business. We have Virginie Mahin, Global Social Sustainability and Human Rights Lead with Mondelez International. Maria Pia Bianchetti, Senior Policy and Advocacy Advisor for the Private Sector with UNICEF UK. And Caroline Doherty de Novoa, Global Head of Knowledge and Dispute Resolution at Freshfields. And my thanks to my Innovation Forum colleagues and Kate Chandler in particular, for pulling this and the other webinars together over the past few days. I will shortly invite our panelists to answer some opening questions to kick things off. We'll then have some follow-up discussion, and I will then open the debate up to audience questions. We do want to hear from you all, so please submit questions using the box on the webinar dashboard, and I will put them to our panel. Please try and keep them short and to the point. If you do, it is more likely that I will use them. We are recording the audio, and you will receive a link to this in due course for you to listen to again and to share with your colleagues. Okay, turning to our panel. Caroline, perhaps you can go first. I thought it'd be interesting to have a quick summary into how the legislative frameworks are evolving. We've been talking for a number of years about the shift from reporting to due diligence. So how has that been evolving in the past 12 months? Caroline.
Thanks, Ian. So we framed this session very much as, you know, evolving legislation, and you've posed the question, you know, how to keep ahead of the regulatory curve. That's one of the things we'll be thinking about today. But actually, I think a really important question is, how do you keep up? You know, before you even think about what's coming, it's really helpful to think about what's already there. And you know, the UN Guiding Principles came out, you know, quite some time ago. And when they did, they said rather coyly, you know, this is not intended to make new law, but everyone working in the field will know that that's really not what's happened. You know, countries, and for, you know, the past 10 years or so, you know, have been concretizing the UNGPs into domestic law in very different ways, and we've seen momentum for that gain in recent years. And as you said, Ian, you know, the focus, at least initially, was very much on reporting. But in recent years, that started to shift to see, you know, stronger duties of due diligence and remediation. And then the penalties have ranged, and, you know, ranged from naming and shaming to civil fines, and, you know, even potential and criminal sanctions for directors, particularly where companies sort of are repeat offenders in not meeting the requirements set out in some of these the various pieces of legislation that are potted around the world. So it is a really complex picture that, you know, multinationals have to face. I did a session recently where we looked at a timeline with a client of events sort of over the past decade, really. And, you know, there has been something really significant every year. You know, starting, you know, if you go back to 2010, the California Transparency and Supply Chain Act of 2010, but then the momentum for stronger reporting requirements between 2010 and 2015, really, there's something every year. If you look at the UK Companies Act, strategic reporting requirements, you know, requiring listed companies to the extent it's relevant to their performance to talk about human rights issues and their related policies and report on that. You know, things at EU-wide level with the non-financial reporting directive. And then the Modern Slavery Act, which, you know, still a reporting obligation and was the inspiration for other things that we've seen in the past couple of years. And I'll come back to that, because then thinking about what's on the horizon, actually, you know, that's now a little bit mature. It's been in place for 5 years, so it's been under review, and it'll be really interesting to see what's going to happen with that. But then beyond reporting and into due diligence, as you've described, that trend has really built a pace over the past 2 or 3 years, I'd say. It's got much greater momentum with the French Duty of Vigilance Act, which requires companies to take publish quite detailed plans across their group, and then put those plans into action, and ensure that they have a system for catching alerts and whistleblower alerts in relation to those plans and any issues that might be arising. And companies can face claims from rights holders who say they've been harmed by a company's non-compliance with those plans. And there's actually a case ongoing at the moment. And so that's, I think, the link. So today we're talking about legislation, but there's a really strong link with legislation and other liabilities and civil litigation in particular. And then, just to name a few more that have come, thick and fast over the past couple of years, the Australia Federal Modern Slavery Act, very much inspired by the UK Modern Slavery Act, but, a reporting obligation which has sort of, a name and shame emphasis behind it. But when you look at the detail, actually, that they've gone further in requiring companies to provide details on their due diligence or remediation efforts and being more specific about what companies have to report on. The Dutch child labour due diligence law, which has already passed but will come into force in a couple of years' time. And then there was a lot of talk in Germany over the course of the past year with an initial, very, very initial draft piece of legislation that was leaked, as quite often happens in Germany with draft pieces of legislation. And so there was a lot of discussion about, what's going to happen with that. And I think, we will see something in Germany in due course. It might not be in the form that leaked document, because that was very initial draft, and there's, consultations going on around that. But I think we will see something from Germany coming relatively soon. And then on an EU-wide level, Germany, France, and the Netherlands are apparently, talking to each other about EU-wide proposals as well. So that's also gaining momentum. So that journey from sort of reporting to, greater emphasis on due diligence has definitely gained momentum over, the past 2 or 3 years. And so it's already quite a complex picture when you think about what's already there, and just that was a very quick canter, but actually what's already there is there's a lot to think about in the different nuances between the different regimes. In terms of what's then coming, as I mentioned before, the Modern Slavery Act is now 5 years older. It's been under review and to look at its effectiveness, to see if there are any tweaks or changes, and there's been a consultation in relation to that. And one change that I think is particularly interesting is changes include a proposal to change what companies have to report on. So they have to report, there's a series of topics that they then may choose to report on. Only one third of FTSE 100 companies, for example, in relation to only they report in relation to the effectiveness of their efforts, which is one of the limbs. I think it's section 54.5 of the Modern Slavery Act. They choose only about a third of the FTSE 100 choose to report on that, which means that there's sort of a large number that are choosing not to report on their effectiveness. They describe their their policies, their risk mapping, and all the other sort of elements that are set out in section 54. And so what the proposal has said is it's looking at, it's consulting on whether that should actually be a mandatory part of the report. In some ways that's a really subtle difference. It could mean that the difference between changing a single word from, they may include in their report the following things to they must include in their report. But as a lawyer, I know, even subtle drafting differences can have a really big and, quite wide-ranging practical implications in the real world. Because if you think about someone then going to sign those documents and having to sign off on the effectiveness of their efforts in a way that they haven't had to before, then you know there will be a greater emphasis on the KPIs, on you know asking questions about, well, you know, what alerts have we had, how have we responded, what action have we taken. So I think that's just something to keep under watch. It'll be really interesting to see where what that consultation goes. And then there are other proposals as part of that in terms of, you know, looking at, is there anything else that the government might want to do to strengthen the Modern Slavery Act, you know, perhaps inspired by what's been happening in other jurisdictions, you know, in terms of civil penalties or public registers or things like that. So I think we should expect to see some changes to the Modern Slavery Act coming up, and it'll be interesting to see what they are. And then two final quick points that I think is good to have on the horizon and thinking about, as you know, one, the role of public procurement in driving transparency through the supply chain. I think there's been a real big emphasis on that. And then finally, you know, this, I say it's on the horizon, but actually it's already here. And in the French example I mentioned earlier, you know, the risk of civil litigation is already here and already, you know, quite live in relation to for companies in relation to human rights issues. And you know, the session is about legislation, but actually that there's you know, real strong interplay between the two, with reporting, with more greater reporting and greater statutory obligations. You know, civil litigation sits alongside that. So that sort of is a real sort of quick canter through what we've already got, how we got here, and you know, a little bit of what's coming up. But great. As you can see, that I think the UNGPs have been a real catalyst for change and moving you know, human rights norms and standards in the business world, you know, have moved and continue to move into hard law. And I think that's just going to set to continue. Especially given consumer interest in this area, investor focus on this area, and wanting to ensure that you know companies are visibly responsible and that there's transparency around that. So it's a really fast evolving field, and I'm really keen to hear from my fellow panelists, because I think because there's so many different aspects to it in terms of what's happening at you know different levels and different countries taking different approaches. That it requires a range of disciplines, and then how the you know, changing legislation impacts the company's operations, but then also its risks in terms of civil litigation, things like that. It actually requires a range of disciplines to think about it and think about the how to chart a path forward.
Thank you, Caroline. Thank you very much indeed. Okay, we can come back to a lot of that. Very good, a comprehensive overview of where we are, but thank you very much indeed for that. Let me turn to Virginie now. Would you be happy to give us some insight into how Mondelez picks its way through that legislative landscape, the challenges around working with different requirements in different parts of the world?
Sure, happy to. But first, maybe let me just remind people who Mondelez International is. It's not always obvious. People know our brands, but not necessarily our corporate name. We're one of the world's largest snacking companies, headquartered in the US. We have chocolate brands like Cadbury and Milka, and cookies like Oreo and Lu, and many more. First of all, as a company, we embrace our responsibility to respect human rights in our value chain, in line with the framework of the UNGPs. And we carry out that diligence in own operations and supply chain. Why I'm saying this, because it's really our starting point when looking at the legislative landscape in this space, and why we're generally supportive of legislative efforts that make it mandatory for all companies to do the same. This being said, the proliferation of different requirements, which Caroline just laid out for you, isn't helpful. And I think for multinational companies in, you know, in particular, this can become problematic, as you know, companies operating in many countries around the world, we need to be looking at the impact we're having on human rights with a global lens. And having different obligations and potentially, you know, conflicting incentives in terms of what should be prioritized in each country where we operate could become very complicated and frankly counterproductive. So What we would like to see is a more uniform approach aligned with the UNGPs, which would level the playing field by setting the same clear requirements on all companies. Ideally, we would see this happening, you know, through a binding international treaty, but we understand we're, you know, a long way away from that. So in the meantime, we're focusing at regional level. In fact, we've been very vocal at EU level in calling for mandatory due diligence. And we really see three key benefits to this kind of legislation. One, as I just mentioned, mandatory due diligence would create a level playing field. So everyone, all companies play by the same rules and incur the same costs. Secondly, it would create legal certainty with a clear set of expectations on companies. And in the case of the EU, it would do so in a harmonized way, avoiding, you know, 27 different set of requirements. And thirdly, and perhaps most importantly, mandatory due diligence would help to mainstream good practices by pushing all actors along the supply chain into action, even those who today don't face consumer pressure. Finally, calling for regulation on the private sector and embracing our duty to respect allows us to also call on governments, and by governments, I mean both, you know, in producing and consuming countries, to play their part and fulfill their duty to protect. In our view, this pillar of the UNGPs hasn't been getting the attention it deserves. Consuming governments, beyond their role to, you know, translate the UNGPs into law, which we see, you know, they're actively thinking about, also need to look at other measures in their policy toolbox to enact what the UNGPs refers to as the smart mix. Due diligence by the private sector, you know, can go a long way, but in and of itself, it will not solve some of the systemic human rights issues that are present in global supply chains. That's our experience in the cocoa supply chain in West Africa, for example, where despite longstanding industry efforts, a number of challenges, including widespread child labor, unfortunately remains. In this kind of situation, we see a very clear role for consuming countries like the European Union, who is by far the largest importer of West African cocoa, but not only to regulate private sector practices, but also to use its trade leverage and its foreign aid to contribute to solving some of the underlying root causes of severe human rights issues like child labor. This is why late last year, we came together with Mars, who I know you'll be hearing from later today in another panel, who's, you know, the other largest chocolate maker, as well as our cocoa supplier, Barrakalabalt, and a large group of NGOs, the Voice Network, as well as certifiers. We came together with this somewhat unusual group to amplify our voice and make a very strong call to the European Union to take action and legislate. For those interested, we released a position paper as that group to explain what kind of due diligence legislation and accompanying smart policy mix we think the EU should implement. And the paper can be found on the Voice Network's website. Finally, I just wanted to come back quickly to the situation in the US, which was highlighted in the introduction for this session. While we're aligned with the spirit of what the U.S. Customs and Border Protection Agency is trying to accomplish with its investigations and import restrictions when they suspect the presence of forced labor, we think that import restrictions is a very blunt approach, which really risks being counterproductive and might create incentives that are, in fact, at odds with the UNGPs. What I mean by that is it can push companies to move away from risky supply chain relationships or countries of production, rather than encouraging companies to, you know, partner with their suppliers to engage in the situation, to try and improve the situation for those who are affected. So yeah, in a nutshell, that's why we think a mandatory due diligence approach is a much more sensible alternative.
Great. Thank you very much indeed. Again, lots we can come back to a little bit later on. Thank you very much for joining us. I know that some of you have been joining us a little bit after the start of the webinar. Do submit your questions using the questions dialog box, and I'll put them to our panel a little bit later on. But I want to hear from the rest of them now. Maria, can I ask you to reflect on the sorts of legislation that you find useful in your work at UNICEF, and how you want rules and regulations to evolve? Maria.
Hi, so thanks, Ian. Thanks for the previous panelists to set up the framework. And I guess one of the reasons why UNICEF UK is working on this sphere is because children are impacted by businesses in many ways. And so, and most of often their impacts remain hidden. So there is a broad understanding of the impacts on child labor, but these the impacts of businesses extend beyond child labor. So for example, you think about environmental pollution, what the impact is on the health of a child, or the working conditions of parents and caregivers, and the impact on a child adequate living standard or access to food. And also because children have additional barriers in access to justice. So in our work, what we see is a broad human rights due diligence as a fundamental way for businesses to meet their responsibility to respect human rights. And this is what, and the reason why is that because the main purpose of human rights due diligence is to prevent adverse impacts on people and the planet. And so as Caroline has pointed out, the evolution that we are seeing now in legislation that is going from a reporting, a reactive approach into a proactive approach is a good thing in this sphere. And is a good thing for everybody, including groups at risk of vulnerability, such as children. And that's because essentially it is moving from an approach that that requires companies to actually take a preventative actions to avoid causing harm. And the various, you know, evolution legislation that we're seeing are helpful because, you know, what we'll create, as pointed out already, is a push for other companies to take action, so they are all at the equal footing. And also, when we are looking at this general holistic and broad approach, so looking at all human rights and not only sectorial approach, what leads to the fact is that this helps, you know, looking at what are the most salient risks, and also this broad legislation, what they do essentially is covering that gap that was created from some sector or specific legislation that look only at certain issues or sectors, which meant that only the consumer-facing companies were pushed to take more action. And the reason why you know, we think about the role of the government and legislation is important in this sphere is because essentially the ultimate responsibility to ensure respect for human rights, for all human rights, lies with the national authorities. And we've seen there have been some surveys in the UK as well, looking at what public and children, young people think. And definitely there is a convergence in looking at you know, expectations of responsible business behavior, but also that the government will address this issue via legislation. And something that is connected to human rights due diligence, but it's not the same, and I think this is important to stress, is the issue of access to justice and remedies, because if rights need to be meaningful, then it means that there needs to be a mechanism in place that ensure accountability when abuses occur. So at UNICEF UK, we have been calling together with other organizations in the sector for the UK government to adopt the legislation that would make human rights due diligence mandatory for all companies and would hold them accountable when abuses occur. And we also had a few months ago a roundtable with some companies, and the main idea was to try to understand what is the experience and the challenges of implementing human rights due diligence and what their views were in regarding this type of legislation in the UK. And one of the outcomes of these views was saying where actually with this type of legislation would harmonize what is the human rights due diligence approach, because indeed there are many many concepts around it. So what we're doing now is that we're writing a policy paper on the subject, setting out why we need legislation in the UK and what are the key elements of this legislation. And this paper will be key guidance for companies that will need to implement this legislation and how they can integrate children's rights considerations when undertaking human rights due diligence. And the key elements that we see as being effective in a legislation like this, and to ensure that an effective preventative approach is taken, is that essentially the requirement to conduct human rights due diligence needs to be broad and realistic, so cover all human rights, but also acknowledge that there are specific groups that are at risk of vulnerability that needs to be specifically taken into consideration, such as children. And that's because in recognition of the fact that different groups may be impacted in a different way, and therefore responses might need to be tailored. And also legislation would need to clarify what is exactly the expectation and responsibility of businesses. So what is human rights due diligence and what is adequate human rights due diligence? And what would be an effective, and then would need to be, you know, an effective enforcement mechanism for this requirement? And meaningful disclosure. And then again, as the other side of the coin, what needs to be put in place is also effective mechanisms that allow victims to access justice and remedies, and that specific barriers are removed, which means essentially strengthening judicial and non-judicial mechanisms and ensuring that these are child-friendly. And also removing additional barriers and allow victims to bring complaints. And one other thing that I think is quite relevant when we're talking about the role of governments and legislation, as Caroline pointed out, is the power of public procurement. And this is because not only governments have the same risk of human rights abuses in their own supply chains, and they should be leading by example, but also because it's one of the stronger levers that governments have to drive responsible business behavior. And so I think definitely like public procurement that looks at human rights due diligence and requires conduct of human rights due diligence is definitely something helpful that would drive an advanced respect of a business's for human rights.
Great. So thank you very much indeed. Loads to come back to and there as well. But I do want to hear from John Morrison. John, thank you for being so patient. Can you reflect on what you've heard from the rest of the panel and how you are encouraging companies and organisations to keep ahead of a simple compliance approach to these human rights issues? John.
Thanks, Eric. Hello, everybody. Hope everybody's safe. 4 points, reflecting on what others have said. The first one actually is a more of a contextual point around the current political situation, which was fraught anyway, but now COVID-19 obviously is putting additional stress on nation states and is creating a huge amount of economic uncertainty. So some people could argue perhaps that in context of economic uncertainty, the last thing that governments will do is introduce more regulation on business. However, I don't think necessarily that's the argument that will prevail, because we might well get used to a higher degree of state intervention over the next months, even in the US and other countries. And also the vulnerability of workers will become increasingly clear, both at home and abroad, both in public and private sectors. And so we could see growing political support for increased regulation on behalf of workers particularly, but also other affected groups. Second point, just a quick, I always think these panels are slightly more interesting if we disagree with each other a little bit. So just to pick up Caroline on, Caroline gave an excellent presentation at the beginning, but she did say near the beginning that it was never the intention of the UNGPs or John Ruggie to create new law. That's not quite correct. John Ruggie was very careful always in signalling that he was agnostic on the issue of whether new law would be needed or not, and design the UNGPs in a way that would allow them to lead to new binding law, not for law for law's sake, but where there was a case to do so. And that is, in effect, what we see is beginning to happen now in different places. My third point, which is really the sort of the drivers and at what level we will see progress around legislation. The UN binding treaty discussions in Geneva have progressed, are more constructive than they were, but I do think they've crossed a Rubicon, which means that it's going to take a lot longer for international agreement on a binding treaty, even if such a thing is possible. My personal opinion is if they'd stuck with the Ecuadorian focus on the advantages of transnational corporations above all other types of business, and actually maybe looked at all the advantages around transnationality, including tax and transfer pricing, etc., move the discussion to New York, they might well have had much more political interest in a binding treaty. The treaty now is focusing very much on all business and the preventative due diligence approach, trying to line up a bit with some of the conversations in Europe. The EU is now more actively involved, but we see China beginning to take a step back from the treaty discussions in Geneva. And that may be a slight breaking, I think, in terms of the G77 consensus around that. I'd also stress public procurement. Others have mentioned that, but also the role of state-backed financial agencies. Again, with the current crisis, we will see much more state intervention and state backing of financial intervention. Export credit agencies, I sit on the advisory group of the UK Export Credit Agency, and yesterday Global Witness lodged a complaint to the UK National Contact Point against the UK Export Credit Agency in relation to climate. I think we'll see more challenges, although these are primarily non-legal, they are still disputes that are going to the states in relation to finance, and I think we'll see a lot more of that, both legal and quasi-legal, checking on the way that finance is backed by states. I think two splinters we'll begin to see. The Mondelez presentation, Virginie, it's amazing, actually. I mean, it's fantastic, everything you said. I'm very proud of you and your company and Mars for taking the stand you have. We will see a bit of a splintering, I think, between the larger companies and SMEs and the business associations that represent them, that will tend to take a much more conservative view on legislation. Those groupings will have to be overcome if there is to be binding legislation at the national or regional level. And similarly, the risk already mentioned, I think, by Virginie as well, or the risk of retrenchment of supply chains because of some of the trade back measures, I think is another risk of the current situation. So let's say my final point then, point four, is let's assume that the global level things are going to take a long time, but that at the EU level, at the regional level, things are going to move more quickly. Going back to Caroline's presentation, the different models that are being tried in Europe in the moment are different, right? They're using different legal approaches. The Dutch child labour approach is consumer protection legislation. The French duty of vigilance law is a corporate reporting requirement with civil liability. The draft Swiss legislation, I believe, is strict vicarious liability, in which human rights due diligence can be used as a defence. So what is the legal model we want within and across Europe, and I include the UK in this discussion? The recent report to DG Justice suggests that harmonisation of human rights due diligence will be possible across EU member states, but it also talks about environmental due diligence. So a question for Europe is whether we're talking about due diligence around, across ESG, or due diligence just in relation to human rights. I think that's a question. And in the UK context, I don't look to the Modern Slavery Act as the best example of what might come. It's riddled with inadequacies, as we know. It should be made stronger. I'd much rather look to the UK Bribery Act of 2010, bringing in a duty for all companies to prevent abuses and an offence of failure to prevent, and the possibility of both civil and criminal penalties. And again, incentivizing human rights due diligence as a defense in those cases. So Ian, I'll stop there. They're my reflections.
Thank you very much, John. Caroline, I want to put that point straight back to you regarding the intention of the UNGPs. Do you want to respond to John's comment about whether or not they were designed to create new law?
Well, I suppose it doesn't really matter because it was quite some time ago, and what has actually happened is that there have been new laws definitely sort of inspired and, you know, as I mentioned, the UNGPs being a catalyst for that. So whether they were, you know, agnostic to whether new laws would come or not or were needed or not that was quite some time ago. But what's actually happened is that, you know, companies have or countries have looked at them and then tried to bring them into domestic law in various different ways. And you know, as we've just been talking about, that leads to you know, different approaches what's the right one is I think a quite an interesting debate.
So I guess they have inspired the sort of changes that in fact John mentioned. So maybe in fact, out of disagreement in the panel, sadly come back to agreement. But thank you very much for clarifying that. Thank you also to the audience for questions are coming in. Thank you very much indeed. First question I want to put to our panel is one around I think a core issue and what activities should be considered to be part of due diligence and what best practice looks like. Let's see. Brittany, but perhaps you can answer that first from Mondelez's perspective. What do you consider to be part of due diligence and what does best practice look like? And if we keep answers fairly short so we can fit in as many questions as we can.
Sure, tough question to answer briefly, but I'll do my best. I think at this stage we do have some good top line guidance in the UNGPs itself, in the OECD guidelines, but it's true that it still remains quite high level. At the risk of kind of staying high level, but it's about depending on your business, it's about looking first, you know, at corporate level, your whole value chain, where are your risk? I think, you know, prioritization is essential in terms of, you know, the severity of the impact on people, but frankly also on the leverage that you have to, you know, have a positive impact on that risk that you've identified. So that's kind of the starting point. And then I think, you know, there's classic measures. I mean, audits remain an important tool, although we know there are limitations and we know we need to go beyond. And then, I mean, from our experience, what's very important and should be considered, including from the policymakers' perspective when they think about due diligence, is the recognition of the need for collective action. I think it's very important for industries to get together and even beyond to work multi-sector wide. When you're trying to address an issue like child labor, which I was mentioning earlier, it doesn't make sense for companies to work, you know, on their physical supply chain and not recognize the fact that it's a much broader issue that, you know, often is cross-sectorial that might affect, you know, within a given country, for example, the whole agricultural sector, and that solutions should be found at that level, really, at landscape or even national level in partnership with the governments in question. That would be my two cents on it.
No, thank you very much. John, I wondered if you want to very quickly jump in there. From your perspective, when you're working with business, what do you advise to be the sort of key things to think about in terms of due diligence?
Yeah, I mean, I think what we're going to see emerge are these thresholds of expectation about what reasonably could be expected in due diligence terms. The challenge will be if this is legislation that cuts across all business sectors and all issues, the legislation itself can't prescribe those due diligence steps. We know through our work on the Corporate Human Rights Benchmark and other initiatives that it's very hard to create sort of cross-cutting due diligence expectations above a general level. The OECD takes it a level down. I think the jurisprudence that arises around NCP cases, I use that term in inverted commas, also is illustrative. So I think the legislation is going to have to require business to look across its peers to find where that level playing field is. And I think OECD sources is one part of it. Collective action benchmarks, if they're state-backed and state-recognized, would be another. So I think there will be a sort of a collection of benchmarks that will be essential for understanding what is adequate in due diligence terms. But then again, certain businesses, just due to their structure, will face risks that even their peers don't. So at the end of the day, I guess courts of law will decide this on a case-by-case basis and relating to the structure of particular companies and the parent-subsidiary relationship and all of this. So the granularity of what level of prevention will be required will become company-specific too. So the boards of companies need to make decisions that best suit the risks and operations of their company alone, whilst bearing in mind the benchmarks of their sector and business more generally.
Okay, thank you, John. I've got a question specifically for Caroline. As legislation continues to evolve, do you know of or use in working with your clients a global human rights legal register similar to the sort of things we have in environmental legislation? So Caroline, is there a global human rights legal register, or is that something that you think might be on the cards?
No, I'm not aware of one. We do, and it actually takes quite a bit of effort to track everything that's happening and all of the different, and we spend quite a bit of time doing that, all the different requirements, because they are, quite often driving at the same thing, but, have different things that are required when you look at the specifics. So we don't. There's not anything that I'm aware of that's out there, which is why it is a challenge for people in companies to look at everything that's already there or that's coming down the line, and then look at sort of specifically what's actually required.
Okay, thank you very much for that. I want to ask a question about child labour specifically. Come to Maria first, and then to Virginie. Our questioners specifically asked around trying to understand the root causes of systemic child labour and how well our panel considers that these root causes are understood. Maria, what's your view on that? How well do you think that the systemic causes of child labour are misunderstood?
There is definitely, when we talk about child labour, the way that leads to that situation is about there are multiple factors that lead to that, and that's why when we talk about systemic issues that are so broad, like one individual action, it is unlikely to provide change, and that's why it is best to take a systematic approach. So there will be multiple layers contributing to child labour, and therefore in this case it's systemic approaches that to look at all the different layers and all the different actors then can indeed provide a better response rather than just one individual actor trying to solve the situation, because indeed it won't be solved by one individual actor taking action. And then in this case, indeed, it's in a number of layers that play.
Fine, thank you. Virginie, you brought up the issue of child labour. How far do you understand, or do you think that the root causes are understood within your sector? And you know, I guess you're working together with Mars, for example, to deal with them.
I think in the cocoa sector, the root causes are at this stage very well understood. I mean, by those working in the sector anyway. I think in terms of misunderstanding, they're tends to be a misunderstanding, I guess, in the way it's reported on by media, which tends to conflate, you know, forced child labor, a form of slavery, with child labor, both of, you know, very severe situations, but they are very different. And what we're seeing in COCO for the vast majority is child labor in the family context. So it's really children helping out their parents on the farm because parents, you know, have no alternative other than rely on their children for labor, for help, because there may not be, you know, a good access to education and so on. But yeah, I think the root causes are very well understood at this stage. I think what the next stage now in COCO anywhere, where industry has come together and we have, you know, the platforms to work on this together, is really about working much more closely and in collaboration with the governments in producing countries. And there are a lot of, there are ongoing conversations at the moment, actually, including UNICEF in those two countries as well, ILO, for a public-private partnership whereby industry and governments would join forces to address the root causes of child labor systemically. And stop looking solely at, you know, each company's supply chain, which I, you know, I really think is the right way to go forward, and a much better way for all to invest towards more effective solutions.
Thank you very much. And I know we are over our allotted time, but I'm going to let things run a little bit longer, given that we've still got plenty of questions I want to cover. So I hope that's okay with everybody on the line. Caroline, I want to ask a question back to you, specifically around UK Modern Slavery Act. Our questioner asks, when will we know more about the changes to the Act? What's the timeline on that? Caroline?
So there was a consultation which took place at the end of last year. Responses have gone in and they're being considered. I think, you know, given that we then had the general election, we had, you know, Brexit, and now we have COVID-19, there, you know, the government is quite understandably, you know, looking elsewhere at the minute. And so I can't imagine there's a lot of work going on right now in relation to looking at those responses. But, you know, when government gets more back on a sort of more business as usual footing, I think there will be support for looking at those responses. And then we'll have to see what, you know, what that analysis looks like once they've looked at the responses. But I do get a sense from, you know, other things that have been proposed over the past few years which haven't gone through, that, you know, backbenchers in particular, and, you know, the people working in government committees you know, are very focused on human rights issues across parties, and so there is some support for change, but timing wise I don't know.
Sure. Okay. Well, thank you very much indeed. John, let me turn to you briefly. All these matters, particularly thinking in terms of due diligence across different sectors, can become quite complicated and complex for businesses, potentially ineffective use of resources. What do you advise around using mandatory reporting and due diligence techniques to overcome that challenge and ensure that companies are able to target the ethical trade issues that are the most pressing for them?
Yeah, you know, I'll have a go at that. I think what needs to happen, and there are not enough incentives for it to happen, but at some point we have to flip from the sort of state of denial everyone's in at the moment about the fact that these systemic risks exist in virtually every global supply chain. Worst forms of child labour is one of them. Different types of forced labour would be another. Types of gender-based violence in agriculture, for example, would be another. And the onus needs to be on companies in a way to prove through their due diligence why they are mitigating and preventing the risks and the harms as best they can. At the moment, the onus is the other way around. So there's no incentive for companies to disclose fully in their modern slavery statements, etc., the true nature of the risk in their supply chains. So I think boards of companies, if that's where we're going to go, and legislation will will flip us to that point at some point. Companies should act on the basis that's already the reality, that that these systemic risks are there, and that the victims of those risks are in some kind of relationship to suppliers or the company directly, and to work on that basis, and to begin to communicate and disclose on that basis, because that's the change that's needed. And then once that becomes the norm, companies that go beyond that, there will there be competitive advantage for companies who have established a norm and are working above the norm. And I do think the current crisis around COVID will put a focus on the vulnerability of workers, because the moment we're looking very much in our own countries, we've retreated, I think, in terms of our nearest and dearest, but just think how vulnerable migrant workers are to COVID-19 in Southeast Asia and the Gulf, etc. The image last week of a migrant worker in Saudi Arabia standing with hand sanitizer sign on his chest and a bottle on pinned to the front of him, and rich people walking up and down and using him as a movable hand sanitizer. Really, for me, that one image reminded me that the current crisis, although you know everyone is suffering, the most vulnerable will suffer the most. So I think that sort of vulnerability lens and acting on the basis that systemic issues are in your business relationships is the step that businesses should take, and will reap an advantage from it, because that will be the defense as these laws come forward. Yeah.
Okay, thank you, John. A strong, very strong image indeed. Okay, final question for the panel, and I'll come down the panel. I'll come down the panel as we started, in the same order as we started. So final question is, what will I be asking about next year? Caroline.
It's so hard to say, because we are in such unprecedented times, so what next year will actually look like. But I think definitely, you know, there might be more movement on the EU side, and what you know that looks like, and whether the harmonization of laws across the EU or you know won't have happened by this time next year, but is more imminent, and what that will mean for companies, and you know the effectiveness of that or otherwise, or what it should actually look like. And when you get down to, because the devil with all these things is really in the detail, and so I think it'll be really interesting if we do move towards that to you know what the detail will look like, and what will actually be required, what the you know penalties will look like, who would enforce it, all those kinds of things. I think will be very interesting, and if there is a sort of coalescing around human rights issues when we get back to a more business as usual world after COVID-19, because there has been, as John said, a focus on the vulnerable and how they're really at risk. And it will be really interesting then to think about, well, how does that work in practice and across states?
Sure. Well, thank you very much indeed. Virginie, same question to you. What will I be asking you next year?
You know, I'm hoping you'll have questions about developments in the EU. I think I'm hopeful. At the same time, I think 1 year is a short time frame for policymakers to move, especially when you have 27 countries to align. And another hope is, you know, based on the conversations that you know we had today around child labor in cocoa, I hope by this time next year we'll have something very ambitious that can also perhaps serve as a bit of a, you know, a model for other sectors around this very close partnership that I mentioned, together with two UN agencies, including UNICEF and the two producing governments. So hopefully I'll have much more to tell you then.
Great. Maria, same question to you then. What do you think I'll be asking you next time?
It might be a word will be about how do you implement this legislation in the UK, but I know time-wise, it will probably not be happening next in 1 year, looking also, at this time that unprecedented. But I think what will be happening more is a much more tailored focus of what it means human rights due diligence and how does this in practice in practice works, and also on how to make sure that what companies are doing is taking a preventative and proactive approach and look at the 360 degrees of all the impacts that they can have, and that they look also specific groups at risk of vulnerability, and they embed it in the whole cycle of human rights due diligence.
Great, thank you very much. And John, finally, what do you hope I'll be asking you next time or next year?
We'll be in a pub and you'll be asking me what I want to drink, Ian. That's my hope. If that's not possible, I think it's going to be the level of integration. At what level of abstraction should integration happen? So I think what's already happening is we're not talking now about modern slavery and isolation from child labor. We're now talking about human rights due diligence across the board. But there's already a decision that Germany has to make under its presidency of the EU as to whether it talks about human rights due diligence in isolation from environmental due diligence. And I think there is a case, and maybe in a year's time we'll be having this discussion, that it's actually due diligence in relation to ESG writ large, and that human rights due diligence, if you like, is the core of that. But as has happened at the OECD already, is that then becomes the framework for all forms of due diligence in relation to ESG. And so maybe that will be the discussion, is at the global level, is it more effective to drive accountability and remedy in relation to human rights as well through an ESG framework? Yeah.
Thanks, John. Thank you very much indeed. Okay, I'm going to have to stop the discussion now. We are running out of time. Thank you very much to our panel for the time and insight. And I look forward to continuing these conversations when we meet in person later in the year. We'll be in touch to share a recording of this webinar so you can listen again at your leisure and share with your colleagues. But for now, thanks for joining us, and I hope you found this session interesting. Next up at 11:30 UK time, we have Chris Ettery from Dell and Laura Okunen from Nokia joining Toby Webb to talk about supply chain risk mapping. And I'll be back at 2 p.m. with a session on supplier engagement and training. See you then, and thanks very much for listening.